Question number 27049.
Mr. Hopewell, Reel 2. Now, could you tell us a bit about sort of typical day's training as a coder? What were you having to learn as a coder?
We had to learn Morse, and we had code books to learn.
Well, tell us Morse first. Did you know Morse at all before you went there?
No, I didn't. I think the pass rate for it was pretty low. It wasn't as stringent as it would have been for someone that was going to be a telegraphist.
So how did they actually train you in Morse? I mean, you know...
Oh, we sat at desks with a little tapper thing, you know.
Did you take to it?
Well, I suppose so. I suppose you accepted it.
You didn't have any trouble with it, then? Because some people have trouble with it.
I don't think I did. Of course, you had to learn all the phonetics or two, A for alpha, B for beta, and all the rest of it, you know. And you had to know that off by heart.
What was that for?
Well, because this is what's needed, isn't it? This is the way, if you're going to spell something out at all, you've got to do it in that fashion, particularly if you're on an intercom or something like that, or phone. Not that I'd had to phone anybody once I was a coder.
So Morse code, phonetic alphabet. Now, what about the coding, the actual coding?
Yeah, there was...
Tell me about what code happened. As much as you remember about it.
I can't really remember, but there were loads and loads of different codes. There was ship, shore, aircraft, ship, and of course there were all different codes throughout all the different areas throughout the world.
What was the method of teaching you the codes?
We had a petty officer, maybe a petty officer signals chappy that was in charge, and he would be the one that was teaching us. There'd be about two dozen of us in a class, I would think, as far as I can remember.
Well, how was it actually learned? I mean, I'm not quite sure how they teach a code. I mean, do they just practice using it, or do they give you lectures? I mean, how do they actually teach you?
So long ago. I think, you know, there probably were talks, lectures, and graphic displays, you know, by blackboard, and you'd have books as well. But even so... You obviously had to pass, and really slung in at the deep end then once you got on board ship.
Anything else that happened at Lonesome or HMS Kabbalah?
Yeah, I'd only been there 2 or 3 weeks, and I was in there Saturday afternoon wandering around the camp, and there was a tannoy thing. It was so indistinct, I didn't think it affected me anyway, and I just ignored it. Next thing I knew, I was hauled up because it was far watching muster and I missed it. So I had to do three separate couple of hours, I suppose, in the galley, cleaning out the blooming cooking pots and things.
What was that like?
All right, because the wrens were in there. They were all right. But nothing dramatic happened there.
And you were there about 3 months?
Well, just 3 months, yeah.
And what happened? So, were you tested at the end of it?
Yes. Obviously passed. The next thing I knew, I left there. I came home for 7 days leave. Had to take my kit bag, the whole lot. And I had to report to Devonport, which is my depot. When I joined the Navy, they asked you which depot you would want, Chatham, Portsmouth or Devonport. I said Chatham because it was nearer to Northampton than the other two, so they put me into Devonport. Not that it mattered a great deal.
And what happened at Devonport? That was just December, was it?
Yeah, that'd be December.
What was it like there?
Oh, very much quite different from training or from... HMS Royal Arthur, Butlins. Quite different. Well, you knew you were really in the serious business once you got down to Devonport.
How? I mean, how did you know? You see what I mean?
Well, there was all the bull and the parades, and you know, you were. It wasn't a it wasn't a picnic. So, I was only in there 2 or 3 days, and I went to the drafting office. which I had to report to. Oh, while I was there, I did do a day's firefighting course on a tip. Well, it had been a rubbish tip, you know, council tip, at Saltash, which was quite an experience.
In what way? Tell us about that.
Well, it was like a great big metal tank, huge thing, two-storey, and you went into it with lights, and there were channels cut in the floor, and there were different sorts of hose nozzles placed around, and then there was nine steps, as far as I can remember, up onto the second floor. And then you had a I think you put a mask on, yes, you must have done, and it was filled with smoke, the lights were out, and you had to go and wend your way through and pick up certain things and come out. And then there was a huge, long tank of oil, not all that wide, I suppose, what, 8 to 10 foot wide, I don't suppose it's very deep, burning oil, which they set light to, and then you had hoses, and you had to go along and put all this out. And I passed for that, so that was okay.
Sounds dangerous.
Yeah, it wasn't really, but it...
So that was that. And then you were saying that, I think you were going to tell us about how you got drafted. What was the procedure when you got drafted?
Well, you went to the drafting office. And I remember going to the drafting office, and the chap behind the counter said, "Huh, something bloody funny here," he said. "You're down for two ships. Which do you want?" Now, I knew that I wanted a small ship as opposed to a battle wagon. I didn't want a cruiser or an aircraft carrier, because I knew that's where all the bull would be. Smaller ships, you get away with less of that sort of thing. And it's more, there's more camaraderie there, and you know everybody. So this is what, and I said the cook. And from that day to this, I never remembered what the other ship was. And I wished I had. I might not have been here today if I'd chosen the other one. I just don't know. But it was an unusual thing to have. How the hell could they put you down for two?
So what happened then?
So then, right, the cook's coming into Belfast. So I had to sleep on the floor in the gym that night before we left. We left early in the morning, probably about six, I suppose. Took the train up to Stranraer, crossed over from Stranraer to Larne, arrived in Belfast, and reported to HMS Caroline, which was a First World War cruiser, which was the depot ship. And all I can remember of that place was stinking of blooming boiled cabbage. It sticks with me today. I can distinctly remember it.
And was this was December 1943?
This is so. December, yeah. It would be...
And was the ship not there then?
No, it was in the Atlantic. And it's supposed to be coming into Belfast, and that's why I was sent there to join it. And I was there a few days. I forget how many days it was. Probably up to a week. 5 days, a week. And they suddenly announced that the cook wasn't coming into Belfast. There'd been some sort of thing at sea. I think they'd fired at something that they shouldn't have done, and there's going to be an inquiry into Liverpool. So you won't be joining the ship here. You've got to go to Liverpool. So packed my bags, and I had to report to the cook in Gladstone Dock in Liverpool. And this was just before Christmas Day, 2 or 3 days before Christmas, as far as I remember. And I thought, son of me, you know, I've come from Lancashire to Devonport to Belfast to Liverpool, all in the space of about a fortnight.
And what were your first impressions of joining there just before Christmas then?
Oh, okay. It was a small ship. Of course, it was American built. Of course, the Navy, in true fashion, had ripped out a lot of the stuff that had been built, put in for the Americans, because it didn't meet Admiralty standards. So where you might have had nice aluminium collapsible tables, you had two iron stanchions with pine wood tops, you know, fixtures. And there were bunks on both sides in the signals mess. And I remember having a bunk.
Tell me about the signals mess then. What was it like? What could you see? I know it's a long time ago, but as much as you spent a lot of time there, I presume.
Yeah.
What was the signals mess like?
Well, it was after the ship, not forward. it also meant that when you're at sea, you could walk along the deck, and then you came down a metal companionway. Now, who's there was a mess on the right-hand side of the companionway. I don't think it was the stokers. I know the ERM, his mess, he was in that mess. And the signals were on the other side. And I think there was a row. The bunks were in threes, one, two, three. And I think there was about four along the bulkhead. Four, three, so 12. Might have been five. I think it was four.
And what were the bunks like? Because, I mean, that's not usual in the Royal Navy.
No.
Not then.
No. Oh, they're, well, you know, like an old iron bedstead, you know, the spring with just the lattice metal wire base. And they folded up during the day. And I think they'd got waterproof covers on. Because this would have been American, you see.
And were they comfortable?
Yes. Well, what you did, you opened up your hammock and put that on top of the base. And then, of course, you got your blankets that you'd got as well. So, yeah, they're okay.
Would you rather have hammocks? Had you had hammocks?
I hadn't experienced hammocks at that time. It wasn't until later on, I think, when I was probably on the Venus that I had a hammock. Hammocks were very, very comfortable, but they had no quarrel with the bunk.
Now, what else was there in the signals mess? I mean, was there a place for you to put your stuff?
Yes, there were lockers on the ground. There were just sort of box lockers on the floor. So you had one of those, so you opened it up and put your stuff in. And then you got the three bunks above. So there were those on the bulkhead side.
And what would you keep in your locker? What sort?
Well, all your spare underwear, socks, probably some more shoes. You know, when you want to go shore, you want shoes, you didn't want boots on, and all your personal stuff and your washery stuff, and things like that.
And anything else about the mess decks that you remember? Was there a table, I presume?
Well, yeah, there were two tables. They just long, narrow tables down the centre, and they were sort of like, I think there were sort of wooden type forms either side to sit on. There were no portholes, of course, because there'd been a frigate, there weren't any portholes.
How did you settle into the ship's routine? I mean, what was the routine?
The routine, normal three watch routine.
Tell me about that. Explain what the watch, because people don't know, and they certainly won't know in the future. What was the normal watch routine?
Well, If you start the midday watch, it's midday till four, then you get first dog watch, four till six, second dog watch, six till eight, then you get the one 8 till midnight, midnight to four, four till eight in the morning to midday. So you've got the watches. And because you've got the dog watches, that splits it round so you're not doing the same continual watch.
Now, how did you fit into the watch system as coders? I mean, what were your...
Three watch. So there were three coders, the three telegraphists, and there was a telegraphist and a coder for each watch.
Now, when you were on watch, where would you do it? Was it in the wireless office?
The WT office, which was underneath the bridge. And the only way you could get to it is going along the deck, through the watertight door, and the doors were such at night. Well, to close them, you've got wheels on either side, and you've got to pull a wheel round to close it. And if you didn't close it properly, the lights wouldn't go on inside at night. And it was there that was my downfall, because I was at sea in the Atlantic, and I was going in midnight or...
Hang on, we'll come to that.
You'll come to that later.
Yeah. So tell me about what happened in the wireless shift. When you're on shift, you've got a four-hour shift, say.
Yeah.
Tell me what you'd do from the start.
Right. Well, I have the seats. There was a telegraph seat and the coder seat, and they were side by side. They were screwed to the deck, but they did revolve round, so you could swing round if you wanted to. And telegraph seat got all the wireless equipment, and he would be taking all the signals. They'd all be put down on a pad, and when he'd finished with it, he'd pass it over to the coder.
Now, how would you know which code it was, or was it always the same code?
No. For a lot of the time, when you're in the Atlantic, it'd be the codes for the Atlantic, and there were various ones. I don't know whether I'm allowed to tell you what sort.
You are, right,
because it's so long ago, and it's old hat now. It's not secret. And this one, one in particular that we used a lot, and
you know its name?
I can't remember.
Okay, that's all right. Sorry.
But what you did, you had a plastic frame. It would be about 14 inches by 14 or 15 by 15, 16 by 16, and cut into it were little holes, windows, in rows, and they were all over the place. There was no pattern to it, so you know you couldn't look at it and think, oh, there's a pattern there, because they were put at random. And you had a they had a book for each month, and it would be for the Western Atlantic or for the Mediterranean, presumably elsewhere in the world. And it was full of figures. Just these sheets were just full of figures. And it was, you decided from the first two groups of figures, if it was a figure, well, it would be a figure code, from all there'd been blocked, the figures would be four figures, but the first two, I think, the first one or first two, were five figures. And you could detect from those how you're going to set up the paper in the frame. Then when you got that set up, you subtracted the figures on the paper from the figure in the window without carrying, and that would give you another figure. Then you went to your code book and you could look it up. If the telegraphist had got it wrong or got a figure wrong, you'd probably come up, instead of 14 degrees north, you'd probably your grandmother's ill or something like that. Well, not exactly, but that sort of thing. And if you couldn't sort of fathom out or decide what it really should be by just working the odd figure, if it was important, then you'd have to ask him to get it sent.
And how quick was it? How long did it take to do a message?
I can't remember. But in the Atlantic, we used to get the U-boat report come through. And it would come through in parts. Part one, part two. And it could be anything from, six, eight parts, perhaps less than six. And you might get part six first, then get part one, then part three.
What would that be?
Security, so you didn't get the whole thing. So until you'd got the last part, which would probably say it was the final, until you got the whole lot, you hadn't got a true picture of what the whole report was. And a lot of the reports, of course, would be U-boat positions. So it would be the degrees, whatever, north, south, and east, west sort of thing, So it was very interesting. And then there were other codes. Was that one called a naval code?
I think the one you just described?
Yeah,
I think it may have been.
Yeah, I think it was a naval code. And of course there was ship shore ones, aircraft and ship ones, which we didn't deal with very often, I don't think, very rarely. There were others, more simple ones, which were letter ones. And the code books, they were like about the size of that tray. Well, not quite.
But they were about 20 inches by 10.
Yeah, but they were weighted. They were led back and front. And we had a canvas bag with our brass holes in it, So if it was abandoned ship, we're supposed to put all the code books into the bag, tie it up top tightly, and throw it over the side. And of course, the weight of the lead would.
So that's what you do. Were there any other duties you had to do when you were,
We did our own messing on the cook. So if it was your mess duty, this would be in the morning when it wasn't your watch. You had to sort of prepare whatever was going to be for lunch, you know.
So it was canteen messing, was it? What they call canteen messing, that's where you prepare your own food. And then
that's it, and take it, it goes to the galley, and then they cook it, and then you bring it back. We didn't have breakfast time, we didn't. The most revolting breakfast time, I think, was the day. We'd have a enamel tray, and it'd have bacon in it that had, I don't think it'd been fried, it'd probably been boiled, I would think, and then tinned tomatoes all in the same thing, so consequently there was no crispy bacon, and all the juice of the tomatoes being there, and it just looked like a lot of red lead.
sometimes, did
you eat it? You either ate it or starved, you know.
And what would you cook for yourself? Because you prepare the dinner and the lunch.
Well, you didn't do pastries, anything like that. But
what would you do?
I can certainly remember doing what we called a pot mess.
What was pot mess?
A pot mess is where you put the meat in, you know, cut up meat, onions, carrots, you name it. It all went in together, and then it was all cooked. It was quite tasty. Now, sometimes, if it was very, very rough, I don't think we did our own catering then. I think the galley had to do it. And they would do invariably a stew, which would be in great big iron pots that were anchored onto the cookers because the ship would be tossing and everything. This is about the only thing that they could cook with safety. And invariably, if it was a very, very rough, it would be a greasy stew. And consequently, those who stomach it could have two or three times their normal ration because there'd be two or three that didn't want it at all. Just couldn't face it.
And what would you get for tea or evening meal, supper, whatever you call it?
I can't remember now.
What about Kai? Would you get Kai?
Oh, yeah, Kai, yeah. It's the old thick cocoa, yeah.
What was it like? I mean, people make a big fuss about it. What was it like?
Very strong cocoa, yeah.
Anything special?
No, it was all right with some condensed milk in it.
What about the rum ration? Would you be old in
that? I wasn't initially, but I know I had rum ration later on when I was old enough to have the rum ration, yeah.
And how was that issued?
Where it took place, but they had the rum tub, you know, and the bloke who dished it out, he was there, and you had, you know, supposed to drink it in front of him. A lot of people didn't. Some of them used to bottle it up and put a few raisins in it. And
well, what did you do?
I think I drank mine.
Was it good? I mean,
yeah, oh yes, better than any you buy today. Apparently you can still buy it. It's called Pusser's Rum. I saw it only a couple of years ago somewhere. It's called Pusser's Rum. I don't think you just find it in the normal wine shop. You know, you probably have to go more specialist one perhaps.
And did they have this business of using rum as currency, sippers, gulpers?
Oh, yes, all that went on. I remember a chap, he wasn't a PO signalman, Eddie Mills. He was a poultry farmer out in the Cotswolds. And he used to bottle his. I think some of them used to flog it ashore. As we did the cigarettes, because you get 20 cigarettes daily ration.
Did you smoke?
Funnily enough, I didn't at that time, but I used to have a cigarette ration, pay six old pence for 20. You'd have anything you wanted, Balkan Sobrani, Senior Service, Players, State Express, all the American brands. And used to keep them in your locker. And when you went into Belfast, When the dockyard mates came aboard, you used to flog them to them for 1 and 6 months. Made a profit. So it gave you a bit more money to run ashore with. Yeah, it was great, great fun.
What about the cleaning of the ship? Would you as communications, would you have to help in it?
Yes, you have to clean your own quarters.
Tell us just your quarters or the whole...
Only our own quarters.
Tell us about that.
As far as I can't remember how we cleaned. I suppose we wet the floor with cloths or mops or something.
Really,
not really, but it's something you had to do. I mean, and there used to be an inspection once a week, you know. Duty officer would come round and he'd look around and see everything was all ship shape, and of course everybody's bunk would all be tied up and tidy and everything else, you know. So they kept a standard, but because being in confined space, you know, it wasn't exactly like the Hilton.
you first joined her in Liverpool. Now, there was an inquiry going on.
No.
You weren't there long, though, were you, at Liverpool?
Oh, no, I was only there a few days.
And then you were then based at Pollock Dock, weren't you, with the 3rd Escort Group?
That's right, yes.
In Belfast.
Yeah, but that not initially, because we left Liverpool. I don't know if I've got it in this diary. No, it's unfortunate. We left Liverpool and went down to Port Said. And that was... We left Liverpool the 30th of December at about 12:30.
Now, this was you were escorted some capital ships.
Yes, right? The Illustrious, the Valiant, Queen Elizabeth, the Renown and the Unicorn.
Now, this was your first time at sea then?
First time at sea.
And what do you remember of that trip?
My God. As soon as we got into the Atlantic, and I was on watch, Ron Easter sat next to me, and we had a bucket between us, and we were sick as dogs, and it was like it all the way to Jib, which was from the 30th of December.
So it was bad weather, was it?
Yes.
Can you describe the weather? And...
Yeah, it was bad in the Bay of Biscay particularly. It was really rough. It's one of the worst trips, I think. Got through Jib.
But can you not describe it a bit more? I mean, you say rough weather. What do you mean by rough weather? I mean, do you mean 1 foot high waves?
Oh, God, yeah. And this was the same in the Atlantic. I'd look through the companionway, if it was in the WT office in rough weather. You could turn and look around 1 minute, you'd see nothing but water because you were down in a trough. And the next minute you look round and you'd see nothing but sky because you were way up. It really was. It was horrendous. And the Atlantic Medal is the only one that I feel I deserved.
What about... The ships were quite famous for rolling.
Right? Yeah.
What was the rolling like?
It's something you got used to. But, you know, being your first trip... It was horrendous, and, you know, we just wanted to die.
How bad was the seasickness then?
Oh, it was awful, because your stomach's training to be sick and you've got nothing to bring up. And we were told, whatever you eat, just eat dried bread, eat something, you know. And it really was awful. Once we got through Jib, we were okay. Once we left Jib to come back, we had another few days of it. After that, we were never seasick again.
None of you, or just you?
Just us. I can't remember. I can't vouch for anyone else. There must have been others in the same sort of situation. But I can distinctly remember me and Ron Easter having this bucket between us to be sick in. It was awful.
And this was, I mean, this presumably wouldn't affect the capital ships as badly as it did you lot.
No, it wouldn't. No, they got a bit of weight with them.
Did you get ashore at all on that trip?
Yes, we got ashore in Portshead, yeah.
What do you remember of that?
The usual, you know, the wogs trying to flog your stuff and all the rest of it. And I remember we were standing, two or three of us were standing somewhere looking in some shop or other, and approached by some of these Egyptian kids, you know, clean your shoes and that. No, no, go away, you know, or perhaps a bit stronger than that. And unknown to us, very quickly, one had come along with some whitening and whiten all over your shoes, so you've got to have them clean then. It was different, because I'd never experienced anything like that. I'd never been abroad before. And
did you find it very strange? Because Port Said's not very English. I mean,
No. Oh, no, it was an experience. It was, you know, it was quite fun in a way.